tiny pine wardrobe, the matching chest of drawers and bedside table, all too new, too orange in tone. He thinks of Sammy next door in his bed, in the easily maintained kitchen, the poor dog as utterly miserable and confused as he is. "What are we doing here, Master?" those amber eyes ask every day. He closes his own and wills sleep to come, but there is the screech of the doorbell, another horribly modern touch, high and shrill, unlike the older bell system at the farmhouse. "Who the hell?" Henry pauses, hoping they will go away, but the shrill noise is repeated. Then a third time, a fourth. Eventually he gets up to see his visitor peering through the central glass pane in the front door. "Oh, goodness, Jenny! Jenny, come in! Sorry, I didn't realize it would be you." His daughter glances around the mess that is his open-plan living. A pile of dirty crockery in the sink, because Henry keeps forgetting to buy tablets for the dishwasher. His overalls thrown over the kitchen table, and his muddy boot prints across the floor. She marches across to the fridge and looks inside. She sniffs the out-of-date milk and shakes her head. The only other contents are some pre-packed sandwiches and two multi-packs, one of sausage rolls and one of pork pies, bought from the local garage. "Right, that's it. I can't bear to see you like this. We're going shopping together and then I'm cooking supper. Come on." "No, love, you don't need to do this. I said I'm fine." "You're not fine. Come on." She is jangling the keys to her car, a battered Fiesta. Henry bought it for the girls to share. Jenny passed her test first time, and Anna was due to start her driving lesson soon. Henry tries very hard not to think of this. He was actually planning to stretch to a second car down the line, so they could have one each. An hour later, and back from the local supermarket, Henry watches his daughter checking all the cupboards for pots and pans to make bolognese. "I'm being lazy using a jar of sauce, but it'll taste all right. Not as good as Mum's, but better than pork pies." She is sizzling onion and garlic in a pan, and he watches her brown the meat and add the sauce, ashamed of his own inadequacy, and wondering when she learned to cook. He hadn't noticed. "I expect you think I'm a right old dinosaur, not being able to cook. Wasn't any need up until now, was there?" Jenny looks pale, and Henry is wondering what it is she has really come to say. He can sense it, the holding back. They tiptoe around each other while the food cooks, and he doesn't push. The meal is good, and Henry is grateful and guilty all at once. "I forgot Parmesan, Dad." "Never mind. I can't tell you how much I appreciate this. It doesn't feel right at all, you looking after me."
"So, is it true? You had an affair?"
"Mum won't say much. She just lies in bed a lot of the day now. She's been sleeping in Anna's room, curled up with her old jumpers."
"Oh, darling, I'm so, so sorry you're having to deal with this on your own, on top of everything."
Henry takes a deep breath. He cannot look at her.
"Okay, I admit it. I was a stupid idiot, and I really regret it, but it didn't mean anything, I promise you. I love your mum, and you mustn't blame her for being so upset. She has every right."
"Do you think she will forgive you? Let you home?" There is a wobble to her voice, and Henry can hardly bear it. It just feels as if everything is gone. Henry puts his hand out to take his daughter's. The gesture makes her start to cry, and next she is saying something he cannot understand.
"I've just had this awful message from Sarah, too. She's still with her sister in Devon, and she says..."
Jenny looks into her father's face, tears dripping unchecked down her own.
"Look, Sarah won't say why. She won't give me any details. But she says we have a right to know that the police in London might be questioning her father over Anna."
"Bob? Sarah's dad? Bob?"
"Yes.
But why? I don't understand."
"I don't know either. I mean, they questioned you. Is it that they question all the dads? Is that all it is?"
"I don't know." "Bob? But why now? Bob's been gone for years. I got the impression he wasn't even in touch with his family." Henry feels the confusion shaping his new expression, the muscles straining with puzzlement. He glances across the floor from spot to spot.
His Wellingtons. The dog back in his basket. The empty shopping bags. A memory of Sarah and her parents when she was little at the village fair. Sarah and Anna on a ride together. New friends, with the four parents making small talk. Bob. Tall and aloof. Handsome. A bit cocky. From the off, Henry didn't like him. And then he remembers something else. How Bob was always taking photographs. Endless photographs of all the children. The family didn't seem to have a lot of money, but Bob had this expensive camera with lots of lenses. Proper camera bag. Barbara said it was nice that he wanted the memories, but Henry thought it was a bit odd. Was rather glad when Bob left the village. No. Surely not. There was a strange new sensation in Henry's stomach. I need to phone Melanie Sanders. That nice DS. She's back at work now. She'll tell me what's going on. Henry is standing to take out his mobile with one hand and raking his fingers through his hair with the other. And you need to phone Sarah again. Go on, Jenny. Please. Push her to tell you what's going on. Ring her now. But Jenny doesn't move. Just staring at him, tears still dripping from her chin. There's something else, Dad. Watching. Thursday. This is not good. Not good at all. I don't like this heat, and she doesn't like it, either. I have to think very, very carefully now. Must not let myself get muddled. I'm not good when I get muddled. Most important of all, I need to stop all these wretched people thinking that this has something to do with them, when it has absolutely nothing to do with them. It's none of their business. If they had just let us be, it would have been all right. But people are so stupid. So now I have to do something to make it all stop. No choice. Their fault, not mine. No choice. Chapter 43. The Witness. So often this past year, I have wondered what exactly makes us the way we are. I don't just mean the nature-nurture thing, I mean the sum of our personality and the decisions we make. All the thoughts that fire around our brain, even when we don't want them to. How we handle the issues of conscience and responsibility. Why I blame myself when others wouldn't. Tony says my biggest problem is that I overthink things, that I take the world on my shoulders, and I just need to relax more and stop going over everything. I sometimes wonder if I would be a different kind of person if I could just learn the trick to do this, to stop with the analysing and concentrate on one thing at a time. But my brain simply doesn't work like that. Never has. I'm always thinking, 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 a million things competing all at the same time. Constant and exhausting buzz. Take today. Like everyone else, I am too hot, but I feel just a little bit embarrassed in short sleeves, because my arms are not what they used to be. As I unpack the flowers, I keep getting a glimpse of myself in the mirror set up on the wall to check the bridal bouquets, how they look held at waist height, so that right now I am thinking not just of the flowers and the heat, but of my fat arms. In fact, I have all of the following thoughts at the very same time. That I should put something up on the blog about how to keep flowers fresh in this weather. Yes, people like tips. That I need to sort out the flower presses with the stock that has gone over in the heat to make up some pretty labels and cards for the window. That I really don't like the way my arms look in the mirror here at the back of the shop, and I wish I had brought a shirt. That I am glad Luke reckons he has found a couple of people who could take over his job. He's going to vet them first, then introduce them to me. Quite frankly, I would rather handle the whole thing myself, but there's been no response yet to my sign in the window, and I don't like to burst his bubble. It seems to make him feel better to be helping with a replacement, so I am letting it be. I am also thinking that I wish Tony didn't have to be away again, that we need to get someone in to check the boiler at home, that I need to do a sign for the window, recommending flowers that do well in this weather, that it is not my fault after all, about Anna. But it still feels it somehow. I just can't let it go. See what I mean? All these thoughts, all at the same time. Small wonder I get so many headaches.
I have ordered in extra lisianthus and roses this week, as both do well together and in these hot conditions. They are long-lasting and good value and very stylish. I must remember to put that on the blog too. Personally, I like all white, but the purple lisianthus are gorgeous, so I've ordered more of both. I'll put most in the cooler, with a few on display to show how versatile they can be. They look so different in varying vase heights. I am trying not to bother Matthew, not least because he is supposed to be taking a break now that his new family is home, but also because my part in this whole terrible case is technically over. I still find it hard to believe. Carl and Anthony apparently in the clear over Anna. A complete shock to everyone, me especially. Matthew says this kind of thing happens a lot during big investigations, a sudden and unexpected twist, which is why you always have to keep such an open mind. Tony, in the meantime, sees it all more simply. He says I now need to just put the whole thing behind me. You see, not your fault at all. Never was, Ella. The problem is that I still keep thinking about her. Anna. That beautiful picture from her Facebook page, hair blowing back in the wind. Where is she? What happened to her, really? I worry now, more than ever, that we may never find out. Goodness, it's 3 o'clock already, and with all the urgent work done, I decide to stop this, to pop home to get a light shirt to cover my arms. Silly, I know, but we are who we are. I finally make it home, and as I pull into the drive, I notice that the curtains upstairs are still drawn. I must have forgotten them when I left. The garden's surviving surprisingly well in this heat. You get a few people raising their eyebrows when I pop the sprinkler on in the evening, but there's no ban, so I don't really see why not. You pay the bill. The porch door jams a little as I try to open it. A couple of those advertising booklets. I wish they wouldn't leave them. Such a waste of trees. I registered for that system which is supposed to block junk mail. It's reduced the flow a bit, but there's still a lot hand-delivered, which is infuriating. Inside, I notice Luke has popped the pile of mail on the little bookcase by the front window, and I skim through it. Phone bill. Someone who reckons we might be interested in new windows. No, thank you. A letter from the bank. That will be the interest rate for our ISIS. Down again. Then I see it. The horrid, familiar, dark envelope. Cheap and thin and nasty, with the pale address label stuck on the front. I lean back against the wall because I simply don't understand. It's over now. Finished. I didn't do anything wrong. Carl and Anthony were not involved, so nor am I. Not really. My heart pounding, I pause to remind myself of Matthew's instructions. I move into the kitchen and fetch the little box of protective gloves and the evidence bags provided by the police. For a moment, I think about popping the envelope inside, unopened, but I find that I can't do that. I have to know why someone would still do this to me. I mean, they must surely have heard on the news that it wasn't Carl and Anthony after all. So why would they still do this? Why? With the gloves on, I rip it open. Same as before. Can hear my breath now. Find myself looking around the hall, through to the kitchen again. Can just see through to confirm that the bolt is across the back door. Good. The postcard is black again. Letters cut out from magazines and stuck on. Messy. Not in a straight line. I am watching you. I stare at it, reading it over and over as I take out my mobile from my handbag, trying to calm my breathing as I dial Matthew's number. Chapter 44. The Friend. Sarah has been dreading this meeting and sits at the kitchen table, tapping her nails against her mug of coffee. The past few days, all the long hours with the police have been utterly exhausting. Caroline, the linchpin of this home, refuge, commune, or whatever you want to call it, has been kind and supportive, and very obviously a rock for Lily, certainly more helpful than Sarah, who realizes only now how desperately she underestimated just how bad going to the police would be. She had expected swift progress, that the police would arrest her father and get answers about Anna quickly, but they can't seem to find him. She thought also that she and Lily would be interviewed together and would be able to support each other, sisters side by side, but she found out too late this is not allowed because of rules to ensure one witness does not lead another. Separate evidence, separate stories, separate spells in a special little unit with its soft green sofa and a basket of toys in the corner, which haunted Sarah as she realized with a horrible tingling of her skin that they were for younger children being interviewed about equally horrid things. The police leading the inquiry into Anna's disappearance were first up. She had to tell them the truth, about the sex on the train and her obsession with Anthony, about the row in the club, how she told Anna not to be a baby and pretty much lost track of her from about 12:30, that Sarah had refused to get the taxi with her when Anna wanted to go back to the hotel, assumed Anna would be asleep when she got back there herself. Next, the awful truth about her dad, the thing he did when she started her period, the text message the night Anna went missing that she had shown to Anna, asking for them to meet him at the bar of his hotel, the reason Sarah is once more worried he might somehow be involved with Anna. Then it was poor Lily's turn. Sarah watched her sister being led into the room with the green sofa while she and Caroline waited outside. Everyone was almost too kind, just a little bit too fussy. Tea, biscuits, lots of offers of magazines and more drinks, but it all took ages and ages and ages. So, Sarah, thank you for agreeing to this chat. It's just we need to make some decisions together. Caroline has her hands cupped around her own mug, the familiar aroma of green tea. Have they found my dad? Caroline shakes her head. At least they're not telling us if they have. Sarah cannot stop looking at the bands on Caroline's own wrists. It's not difficult to work out why she runs this place. So the thing is, I've been talking to social services about going forward now. This is unexpected. A sweep of dread through Sarah. Social services? She had no idea this place would liaise with social services. She thought it was independent. The reason it was so off-piste. Own rules, own oddball way of doing things. No pressure to involve the police unless you want to. It's because of your age, Sarah, Caroline says, as if reading her thoughts, and the fact that your mother wants you home. It complicates things. I don't want to see my mother. Can I stay here, please, with Lily? Caroline nods, and Sarah finds that she is crying with a sudden relief, no longer hearing properly, as Caroline goes on to explain about enrolling her in a local sixth form, the various protocols and conditions, that she will sort it all out. Caroline reaches out to take Sarah's hands and tilts her head. Lily still has problems with her anorexia, and I am very concerned about how a trial over your dad, if it gets to that stage, will impact on her. So I need you to cooperate with my house rules if we take this forward, not talking to people about why we are here, that sort of thing. Will I have to wear the bracelets and have a new name? Sarah has no idea why she asks this so quickly. It sounds rude and ungrateful. Sorry, I didn't mean to say that. But Caroline is laughing, which makes Sarah relax even more, the relief now reaching the tips of her fingers, her toes, her cheeks flushing. You find all that a bit kooky, Sarah? A bit. No pressure, but you might find both help. The bracelets are terrific for easing tension, something to fiddle with when you feel overwhelmed. I introduced them to help people who self-harm. Sarah is suddenly thinking of the marks on her sister's arms before she left home. What about the names? Why did you pick Saffron for Lily? Because she came here like someone who wanted to be invisible, to disappear. That's why she stopped eating. And then one day, when I saw her painting, I saw this entirely different person, this vivid energy and colour on the page, spicy, evocative, memorable. Look at me. And I felt that was who she was meant to be. Sarah cannot stop her tears, and Caroline squeezes her hands very gently. There is a lot to sort out. Your mother wants contact, and we will need to liaise very carefully over that. But if you accept my offer, and you wanted a new name, again, Caroline seems to be reading her mind, I would suggest Dawn. Just something for you to think about.
Why Dawn?
Because you don't like yourself very much, Sarah. And no girl of 17 should hate themselves, especially when they have experienced what you have. You need a fresh start, lovely, in my opinion, and it is just my opinion. You need the sun to come up. Chapter 45. The Witness. Trends are such a funny thing. Greenery is back, big time. Suddenly we can't get enough glossy greenery in to bulk out our bouquets and displays. All the restaurants and the brides want it everywhere. Green table runners, green arches for the doorways, luscious leaves everywhere. It is a bit like the popularity of baby names. Trends creep up on you. Suddenly everyone is called Amelia. Suddenly everyone wants greenery. I don't mind, actually. Change is good, and I enjoy gathering my own greenery from the garden and local lanes. I have always grown lots of hostas for the large leaves and curved shoots, and have found that cuttings from our laurel hedges are working well for larger displays, too. It is good to be doing new things, and to be frank, I need something to distract me. I hate this new limbo. 2 weeks since that new postcard, and zilch progress. I handed it straight over to Matthew, who passed it on to his friend Melanie Sanders. They ran the usual fingerprint tests, postmark inquiries, blah, blah, nothing. Whoever sends them must wear gloves. Turns out the haters can be clever as well as cruel. Right now I am making up today's final birthday order while Luke holds the fort front of house. He's looking so much better, and the two contenders interested in his job are calling in to see him later while I'm in Cornwall with Matthew. He'll vet them first. I'll only see them if they are okay about the hours. I've had a couple of time wasters over the ad in the window, horrified at the very early starts. I guess teenagers like their weekend lie-ins. I set everything out as usual, ribbons, tape, pins, and begin the bouquet. A combination of roses and stocks in pink and purple with some rosemary for the scent. I do my usual trick of twisting and building slowly to keep the balance and the rhythm. It is a 40th birthday bouquet, and so I add in a couple more flowers than usual, as I remember my 40th so well. I check the display, bind it, trim the ends, and then pop it into a vase just to circle it, walking round to check from all angles before wrapping it in tissue and ribbon. I pop it into the cooler and move through to Luke, to remind him that it is not for delivery, that the husband is calling in for it later. It's prepaid, all written up in the book. And then I check my watch, and Luke is telling me not to worry about the shop, that he has it all in hand, and reminds me he is seeing his potential replacements later. Girl first, then boy. They both did the 10 tours same time as him, apparently, so are solid. Used to early starts. Reliable. If they both seem sane, he will leave their CVs and contact details on the shelf under the counter, and I can decide whether to see them myself or to advertise. He would like to stop working by Christmas at the very latest, so that he can concentrate on his studies. Is that okay? I smile. I like that Luke is doing this for me, that he is sleeping better and doing okay back at school. It's been a tough time. And then the text comes. Matthew is waiting in his car outside. I don't want Luke worrying. I tell him I am off to see a potential client in Cornwall and will be back late afternoon. I kiss Luke on the forehead and he pulls a face, so I wink my goodbye and remind him to text if there are any worries. I warn him that Cornwall can be a bit patchy for signal, so not to panic if I don't reply immediately. Climbing into Matthew's car, I smile at the evidence of his very different new life. Dark circles still under his eyes, the parental clutter of a nursery rhymes CD, spare bibs, a pink blanket in the back, a soft yellow duck on the parcel shelf, the baby on board sticker, which Matthew tells me his wife insisted upon. You sure you're feeling okay about this, Ella? Matthew looks over his shoulder as he reverses out of the parking space. I think of the headlights that so frightened me those early mornings in the past. This was the exact parking spot. It was probably someone in the flats above the shops. I put on my seatbelt
and try not to dwell on it. Enough now, Ella. A bit nervous, but I want to come. I didn't honestly know what to think when Matthew first rang me. It was a shock. Mrs. Ballard getting in touch with him. At first I wondered if it was to be some kind of formal complaint, me sending him down there that time, suspecting her of sending the postcards. But no, something even more surprising. It is starting to rain, and Matthew apologizes. His windscreen wipers make an annoying squeaking noise. He tells me that replacing the blades is on a long list of things he may not get around to until his daughter goes to university. I laugh. He laughs. It gets easier, I say, once they sleep. Oh, I'm not complaining, he says, and he is wearing that open expression I so like. Relaxed, straight, kind. I find myself looking at his profile and wondering again why he left the force. He avoids the question very cleverly whenever I raise it. We make good time, stopping only to buy takeaway coffees. We listen to the radio mostly, and only once we are within 10 minutes does he talk through his own strategy. Clever of him not to wind me up earlier. The latest from the Met Police is not good news. They have just discounted Sarah's father from the inquiry into Anna's disappearance. He was found in Norwich somewhere. I don't know the details. In fact, I'm not supposed to know this at all. But off the record, Matthew says that CCTV from the hotel he was staying the night Anna went missing, along with mobile phone tracking, has provided a cast-iron alibi. He was in his hotel room when Anna went missing. No question. Cameras in the hallway show he only emerged when Sarah's mum phoned him. Mrs. Ballard is now desperate. She wants to employ Matthew herself to review Anna's disappearance, to try to see if the police have missed anything. She believes the case has gone completely cold. With no suspects left, the investigating team is being quietly reduced in number. Matthew, equally surprised by her sudden approach, says he has made it very clear that he is highly unlikely to be able to make progress alone, but he feels compassion for the family and wants to at least hear Mrs. Ballard out. However, having been engaged by me first over the postcards, there is a potential conflict of interest, and that's why he has asked me along. I remain almost certain that Mrs. Ballard isn't behind the cards, but I need to see you in the same room to make this call. I hate to be so blunt and to use you like a guinea pig, but that's where we are, Ella. He has said this already to me on the phone, and I do understand. I can't just work for you both, but I do worry about whether this Anna case will ever be solved now. It's very sad for the family. Very tough. He's glancing at me. But it's upsetting for you too, Ella. My first call is your feelings. I know that. And I don't think I'll ever be happy until they find out what happened to her. I pause. Do you think there's any chance at all she's still alive, Matthew? Very little. But Mrs. Ballard won't want to hear that. The mothers never do. Again, he glances at me, and then at the baby clutter. I'm only coming to completely understand that now. We drive in silence for a time, and I glance at him once, twice, finding myself frowning. Do you mind me asking again, Matthew, why you left the force? It seems such a shame to me. You seem so very good at this, so decent. He keeps his eyes fixed firmly on the road ahead as we see a signpost for the farm, a right turning ahead. Guilt. He says the word quietly, turning to me as I narrow my eyes. There was a case. A child died. It wasn't my fault technically, but... I see his eyes change and wish I had not pushed him. I fidget with the seatbelt as he clears his throat and indicates to take the turning. I understand now. Okay, here we are then. You ready for this, Ella? I nod, and my stomach grips as we take the strange, narrow approach road to the farmhouse. I'm thinking of that awful time I came down here myself, the tussle on the doorstep, the other reason Matthew says he needs assurance that Mrs. Ballard has finally made peace over my own place in this. As she opens the door, Mrs. Ballard's face is strained, her tone all effort. She looks older and thinner, and I feel so sorry for her. I can't thank you enough for coming. Both of you. At first, she cannot quite look at me. Not yet. And I see Matthew taking this in. She fusses over making coffee, and though neither of us needs a drink, we accept her clattering about as an icebreaker. Something to ease things. I admire the kitchen, the house, the large arga. And then I feel embarrassed at my small talk, noting the pictures on the fridge. Anna as a little girl, unmistakable with her striking blonde hair. In most of the snaps, she is with an older girl. A sister, I assume. A few other photos with friends. A shot in a paddling pool. Anna doing cartwheels on the lawn. Matthew kicks off the business discussion. He asks Mrs. Ballard outright if she understands that he remains engaged by me to investigate the postcards. Is she comfortable with this? I understand from Ella that you visited her shop in the past, and that you were very upset when she called here once before. That was my fault, I say quickly. No. Mrs. Ballard leads the way through to the sitting room with her tray. It is a gorgeous room with French doors onto the garden. In the corner, a beautiful grand piano. I was not myself, Ella. I apologize. I can understand why you might have thought it was me who sent the postcards, but I promise you I didn't. I came to the shop because at that time I did blame you. It wasn't fair, but I just didn't know where to put my anger. I do understand. Matthew talks for quite a while about the difficulties of these kind of investigations. He talks about his contact in the force, about the frustration at the dead ends. The confirmation that Sarah's father, who remains in custody on other matters, has a cast-iron alibi for the night Anna went missing. Mrs. Ballard says she's heard the same via Sarah. So, no suspects left. Mrs. Ballard puts down her mug. Which is why I need your help, Matthew. I have some savings. The desperation in her voice is dreadful, and I watch her eyes as Matthew says he will need to think about things and get back to her. There is this terrible impasse, and so I admire the piano, mention that I had lessons until my teens, and regret giving it up. I move over to examine it close up, and to take in the beautifully framed photographs along the top. Anna with her sister again, as bridesmaids, family groups. And then, such a shock. An extraordinary punch to my gut. The disorientation so great that I feel unsteady. Who's this? I pick up the photograph and turn to Matthew and Barbara Ballard, an image from the past forming again in my mind, not understanding this. That's the girls with a friend when they did the 10 tours. Mrs. Ballard's tone is wary. But he was on the train. I'm sorry? This boy, the boy with the curly hair, he was on the train to London that day. When Anna went to London. I'm sorry, but you must be mistaken. No, no, that's not possible. He was away. I'm telling you, it was him. I am looking at the photograph again, and then at Matthew, who has stood up and is walking across to me. It was definitely him, Matthew. I nearly spilled my coffee on him. It was after that awful scene, when I passed the toilet. Sarah, oh Sarah, when I decided to move seats to the other end of the train. We were going around a bend. I lost my balance walking through the aisle. I'm sorry. The lid loose on my coffee. It's okay. Don't worry. It's fine. He looked right at me. Definitely him. That hair. Those eyes. Who is this, Mrs. Ballard? Matthew has taken the photograph from me and is holding it out to her, trying to make her look. Chapter 46 Anna July 2015 She is shocked and shaken, but also angry with Sarah. She marches after her to try again, pushing through the people all crowded together, dancing and drinking. Suddenly the club is too dark, too noisy, too alien. The smell of sweat and alcohol everywhere she turns. She feels a little giddy. We promised to stick together. She grabs at Sarah's arm, but can hear that her own words are slurring slightly. Sees now that Sarah is unsteady too.
We really need to go now. I don't feel safe.
Please, Sarah, I'm begging you. Oh, for goodness sake, don't be such a baby, Anna. So dramatic.
Sarah again shakes her off.
I told you already. If you want to go, just go. But I'm not ready. Why don't you just lighten up? Have another drink.
I've had enough here, Sarah. We need to go.
Then you go. I'll see you later, back at the hotel.
And then Sarah is gone again, through the crowd, heading after Anthony into one of the other rooms. Anna stands very still, just watching her. She has to position her legs wider apart to stop the swaying. Everything is swaying. The room and the shadows and the lights and the people, the music pounding right through the floor and up through her body. She feels her eyes narrowing and her vision is ever so slightly blurred. She sees a man looking at her, swigging from his beer bottle. He winks. She looks away, suddenly all paranoia. Again checks her handbag, its long strap across her body, checks the zip, her purse, her phone. She follows the signs to the toilets and waits for a free cubicle, puts down the lid, sits down and leans forward to try to calm herself, takes out her phone. She skims the contacts. Home. She looks at the word, blurring in front of her. She thinks of her dad in the car, how angry with him she was. The photograph. Him and that woman. She lets her finger hover for a moment, but then, no. She wipes her thumb against her dress. She considers the fallout, that her mother will never, ever let her do anything on her own again. She sits for a while, wonders how long it will be until she feels more steady. For just a moment, she thinks of Sarah's dad, but then remembers the warning. If you phone my dad, I will never speak to you again. Anna has had too much to drink before, but never on her own. Not like this. She wishes that she had downloaded the app for taxis, but Sarah had said she would do that. She has no choice then. Anna decides to go outside and hail a cab. She remembers that it must be a black cab, has read about the danger of fake minicab drivers. She feels afraid, and so to calm herself, she tries to picture herself in the back of the cab, safe, right up to the front door of the hotel, where she will ring Sarah and maybe her parents next, even the police, if Sarah still won't listen, still won't come. Outside, it is drizzling. There are a few people smoking, quite a narrow street, hardly any traffic. She waits a while and tries not to look at anyone. But no cars pass, no taxis. She sees the bouncer at the door and wonders if he might help her find a cab, but he is suddenly distracted by a group of three men who are playing up because he won't let them in. She's getting wet, still feels so unsteady on her feet, and then, Anna, what on earth are you doing here? She turns, and relief and surprise and a whole myriad of emotions flood through her so that she bursts into tears. Tim! Oh my God! He is shushing her, and she is embarrassed and relieved all at once, wiping her face with her sleeve. Oh God, Tim, I'm so pleased to see you. But what on earth? I thought you were in Scotland. She is clutching at both his arms, using them to steady herself. Confusion, relief, disorientation. Where's Sarah? Tim is looking right into her face.
In the club. She won't come. I'm trying to find a taxi. I can't make her come.
Well, you won't find a cab here. No chance. He's glancing around the street. Come on, this way. Let's get you out of this rain. Tim is leading her then by the arm, and she expects him to take her into a doorway, a cafe or a pub or something. The tube? But he is saying that the tube stopped hours ago, and they need to get a place where they can order her a cab. This way. We need to take the night bus, just a few stops, then we can get you a taxi easily. They seem to be walking quite a long way. A bus stop, then on the bus, no one else. She asks, does the bus go near the hotel? She gives him the address again. He says no, it doesn't go that far, but she is not to worry. They will be able to order her a cab for the last stretch. And then they are off the bus, walking again. And Tim is saying, "Here it is, the flat. Here, we can get you dry and order the cab from here. Wait in the dry." She can hear the keys jangling. There is a porch which is keeping them dry. And then they are inside. A narrow hall, then a sitting room with a bay window, brown curtains. He's explaining that this is the flat left to him by his father, to be rented out so the income can fund him through uni. That was the deal in the will, the reason he is in town. The trip to Scotland got cancelled. This flat is normally let. "Remember, I told you all when my dad died." She does, sort of, vaguely. Tim's dad showed no interest in him all his life, then suddenly got cancer. Got God. Got in touch. No one else in his life, so put Tim in his will. She is glad to be safe, out of the rain. But where is the tenant? And how far are they from her hotel now? Tim says the tenant has just done a bunk, and he's in town to tidy the place up, sort out a new lease. He was planning to contact her tomorrow to explain Scotland was cut short, see if he could meet her and Sarah after all. "I thought you girls were at a musical tonight." She explains how the club was recommended online, does not mention Carl and Anthony. Ashamed. She can hear her words slurring still and tries to speak more slowly. She feels so embarrassed, does not want Tim to judge her. She is trying to sound sensible, but she is wondering now what he was doing near the club. He says he had a curry with a mate at an Indian nearby. "Just as well, eh? You shouldn't be on your own, Anna. Not in London, especially that bit. Dodgy area." "You were there?" "It's different for blokes." And now Anna needs to sit down. She's still so woozy. "Right, we need to make sure Sarah is okay too," he is saying. "I'll go back for her, once you're okay. She'll be safe in the club for now." He is taking out his phone. She hears him ordering a cab for her. Double checks the name of her hotel. He says cabs are more reliable this time of night when you order them to come to an address. They are saying it will be 15 minutes. Not too bad. Right. So he will see her off safely, then he will go back himself for Sarah, bring her to the hotel. Is she okay with this? Anna is thinking that maybe they should have gone back in for Sarah straight away. She is grateful, but confused, and begins to cry again. He is sitting next to her, his arm around her shoulders. Tells her not to worry, that it is all right now, Anna. He is going to make sure that everything is all right. And then she closes her eyes, and she is remembering the awful picture Tim sent her this morning. Her dad, with April, Tim's mum. She hadn't wanted to mention it, to think about it even, but wonders why he hasn't said anything either.
"Why did you send me the picture, Tim?"
She is still crying.
"I mean, why this morning?"
It hit her phone just before her dad drove her to the station. Such a terrible shock.
"You disgust me."
"I just felt you had the right to know. It was a terrible shock to me, too. I thought we should decide together what to do. Whether to tell your mum."
"I wish you hadn't. I had a big row with my dad."
"Sorry. I didn't think."
"But how did you get it? The photo?"
It was so graphic. So foul. Her dad and April. Naked. Her legs up in the air on the bed. Like porn. Disgusting. And now Tim is standing, saying he doesn't want to talk about that anymore just now, and that he will make them coffee. It will do her good. She is thinking that there isn't time, surely. No point, with the taxi. But he says even a few sips will do her good. The state you're in. While he is gone, cluttering about in another room, Anna begins to glance around. And now she doesn't understand. There are quite a few books on one of the shelves. Walking books and map books. And there are magazines, too. One she knows that Tim likes. She narrows her eyes. There's a stack. Months' worth of them. She looks down at the coffee table. They're from the past 3 months. It doesn't make sense.
"You okay in there, Anna?"
"Fine."
She reaches down to the shelf under the coffee table to find a book of walks in Cornwall. A frisson of unease passes through her. The book has several places marked with bookmarks. No, not bookmarks. She flicks the pages to find that they are photographs marking the chapters. The first makes her smile. It is a group shot. That birthday party her mum threw for Tim. They are wearing hats made from balloons, and she and Sarah are clutching sausage dogs that the boys made. Tim and Paul. She turns the pages to the next photograph, and then suddenly there is this truly odd feeling within her, like a change of temperature. For it is a picture of her, taken from a distance. She is at her bedroom window looking out, just about to draw the curtains. Anna can feel her heart rate increasing, her muscles tensing. She flicks through the book to find more pictures, just of her. Her playing on the lawn, her sitting in a tree, all of them taken from a distance. She puts the book back and stands, just as Tim returns with two mugs. How long till the taxi, Tim? Not long now. I think I need the loo. She tries to hide that her hands are shaking by her sides. Sit down. You'll be back at the hotel in a moment. You can go there. There is a change in his tone. Clipped. Not nice. Not Tim. He is standing between her and the door. She looks at him, the temperature even colder inside her. The bathroom here isn't nice, Anna. Oh, right. Drink your coffee. Just remember, it's a good job I found you. Finally, he sits and sips his drink. A very good job I watch out for you, Anna. But I always watch out for you. Yes, very true. I'm grateful, Tim. She is looking at the magazines and the book of walks, her heart thump, thump, thumping in her chest. Did you say the tenant did a bunk? Yeah, last week. We need to find another tenant. He has started to rock in his seat, to and fro. She can feel her shoulders starting to tremble and is worried he will see this. She looks at the books on the shelves, notices that some of them are A-level books, Tim's A-level subjects. Let's wait in the doorway. Look out for the cab, shall we? She has stood up again. No. Sit down. Drink your coffee. That clipped tone again. He twitches his head, rocks faster. I think I need the air, Tim. You're fine, Anna. You're with me now. You're fine when you're with me. She sips her drink. She can hear her breath, her pulse, her heart. She can feel the dread building and building, the temperature falling and falling, but knows, too, even through the booze and the fear, that she must not let him see this. Little black dots on the edge of this scene, closing in, not real. Could I have some water, Tim? No, you're fine. Tim has started to rock faster. To, fro, to, fro. He is all agitation suddenly, strange, jerky movements of his head. It's okay, I'll get the water. She stands and moves towards the door in the hall, slowly at first, but then faster, and suddenly he is grabbing at her from behind. Instinctively, she kicks back hard with her right leg, and he recoils for a moment. She makes it through to the hall, just feet from the door, but feels a blow suddenly to the back of her head. Blackness for a moment. Then her eyes open. She's on the floor. Black and white tiles, cool beneath her palms. A brass letterbox. She is trying to scream, but there is something over her mouth. Flesh. The smell of sweat. She tries to bite into the flesh, but cannot open her jaw. She puts up her left hand to her head. A terrible pain. Blood on her hand as she puts it back down, still trying to move his hand from her mouth. All the time he is saying things over and over. Mad things. That she is safe with him. Only him. His voice, muddled and mad. And dreadful. That she needs to let him look after her, watch over her. That it was much better when they were children, easier to keep her safe when they were children. She tries to crawl, that brass letterbox. And then she hears a new sound,
a sort of lashing through the air. He has grabbed at something from the coat hooks to their left. For just a second, his hold on her is loosened. She lunges forward. The door. The latch. Please. But there is something around her throat now, pulling her back. The smell of leather. Then, a new pain. Much worse. She can't breathe. Choking. Choking. She puts her hands to her neck, tries to squeeze her fingers between the belt and her flesh. She sees pictures suddenly, all swimming and changing and blurring. Her dad in the car. You disgust me. Primrose is on the lane at home. Sammy, the dog, his head turned to look at her. She is fighting and squeezing with her fingers, trying so desperately to get back to them. Her mother in the kitchen, the smell of cinnamon, plum slices. Betty Anna. Squeezing, squeezing with her fingers. Her father with Sammy on the lane, walking back to the house, ruffling her hair. Primrose is for Mummy. She is calling out to them, to all of them in turn, but they cannot hear her. Instead, this terrible gurgling in her throat, pain in her chest. Still, she fights and fights and fights. Cartwheels on the lawn. Jenny smiling at her. Sammy yapping at her heels. Please. She has to fight. She has to tell her father that she loves him, really. She has to get back to them. Please.
Chapter 47. The Witness.
I'm telling you, he was in Scotland. Mrs. Ballard is just muttering. I saw a picture on Facebook. Tim in Scotland. You're wrong.
I am staring at Matthew, bile suddenly in my mouth.
Tim has been devastated over Anna. He has always adored her.
Mrs. Ballard continues to babble.
No, no, Tim was in Scotland.
All confusion. All terrible and dreadful confusion as Matthew takes out his mobile. He is all sharp focus, and I am both impressed and somehow terrified by this, Matthew's tone so clipped and urgent, and fueling the terrible dread inside me. He has his contact, Melanie Sanders, on the phone, and is running conversations in stereo. I'll explain later. New key suspect, Anna Ballard case, family friend. We have to get around there right now, Mel.
Tim, what's his surname?
He has turned to bark the question at Mrs. Ballard, who is still dazed, muttering about how wrong we are. That Tim has always worshipped Anna, ever since they were little.
Tim's surname and address. Now, Mrs. Ballard. Black House. Ryder Lane. I can't remember the number. He's a nice boy. A nice boy. I tell you, you're wrong about this.
Tim, Black House, Ryder Lane, same village, stay on the line, Mel, and I'll tell you more as I get it. He was on the train to London with Anna, other end of the train, lied about being in Scotland. There is a pause as Matthew listens. Don't know, Mel. Hang on. Is there anyone who might know where Tim is today, if he's not home? This is urgent, Mrs. Ballard. Look at me, please. Really urgent.
Jenny, I suppose. Jenny might know. She's upstairs watching a film. I didn't want her down here while I talked to you. I don't want her upset.
Call her down, right now. 2 minutes later, and Jenny, taller and darker than her sister, is standing in the doorway, all angry, confrontational body language, arms folded.
What's going on?
I'm an investigator, Jenny, and I need to know urgently how to find your friend Tim. I don't have time to explain. Do you know where he is today?
Devon.
Where in Devon? Why is he there?
She shrugs at first, pulls a face, uncooperative.
What's it to you? This is really important, Jenny. The police need to know urgently.
To know exactly? About a job? He didn't say. Someone he met at the 10 Tours. He's been on and on about it lately.
About what? The job?
And now there is a cold tremor through me. I am staring at the photograph from the 10 Tours. The date confirms it was the same year as Luke. Confusion. A frown. I am thinking suddenly of that map magnifier that I found on the floor by the shop. It was given to all of them. All the teams who made good time. Dear God.
No, the 10 Tours. He's been going on about the 10 Tours.
Jenny's voice, still angry. I am standing up again now, bile in the back of my throat.
What job?
The panic in my voice makes everyone turn towards me.
Some shop. He didn't say where.
Look, he's been very upset lately, okay? You need to leave him alone. Leave us all alone.
Look, Jenny, Matthew's tone is firm. I don't mean to frighten you, but this is about Anna, and we need to find Tim very, very urgently. Why has he been upset?
He was getting out all the old photos of when he did the 10 tours with Anna and everyone. He was looking for someone in the photos, some boy he reckons Anna fancied. I don't know why. I told him to leave it. Look, he's just upset, okay? We're all upset.
Look.
It comes out like a cry for help. I want to be gone. In the car. I have to get back to him. I start to move towards the door. I don't understand this. It makes absolutely no sense, any of this. But I have to get back to him. And suddenly I can see them all milling about. Hundreds of them. I am looking again at the photograph and can see it. Anna getting her medal. All of them getting their medals. Luke. Tim. Everyone laughing. Everyone so happy.
My son Luke. He did the 10 tours. The same year.
He's at the shop.
On his own. Luke, we have to go, Matthew.
Stop, Ella. Talk to me. Look at me.
He's seeing some people about taking over his job. Oh, dear God. He said they were from a 10 tours Facebook group, and I found something outside the shop, Matthew. I thought it was Luke's, but I'm worried now.
Right, ring him. Ring Luke now on his mobile. I do as I am told, my hand trembling.
Come on. Come on, Luke.
There's no answer.
I turn to Matthew, heart pounding, the taste of bile still, all the muscles in my face hurting, not understanding. Luke's voicemail in my ear. Try the shop line. Try to stay calm. Try to keep your voice calm, Ella. Did your son know Anna?
No, no, definitely not. I mean, he would have said.
I am looking at the date on the photograph. The same year. I dial again as Matthew is talking once more to Melanie Sanders. Right, long shot, Mel, but Tim may be at the witness Ella Longfield's flower shop, Trondale High Street. Her son's alone there, Mel. He's called Luke. I'd call it in as urgent, but no sirens.
I don't understand.
I am the one now muttering. The line is ringing, but no answer.
My Luke? Why my Luke? I don't understand any of this.
Chapter 48. Luke. Luke is pleased with himself. Jessica seems quite nice. A little bit on the small side and didn't seem too keen on lifting. Moaned about the 10 tours doing her back in. That might be a problem, helping with the deliveries. She also had very long nails, he noticed. Might stop her from getting stuck in. But she was nice. Local. Friendly manner. Says she doesn't mind early starts and needs the cash. Mum would like her, so he will definitely pass on her CV. He checks his watch. Tim next. Running a bit late. Not a good sign. Mum likes punctuality. From the Facebook group, seems they both did the tours the same year as him, though he doesn't remember them. Jessica or Tim. So many people. But anyone who could face the tours has stamina. And commitment. So a good vetting process. Yes. Luke feels chuffed with himself for thinking of this. Nice part-time job. Trondale shop. Interested? Message me. He's glad things are slowly improving at school and doesn't want to leave his mum in the lurch. Wants to thank her for her support. But not many young people want to get up so early for a job. If she doesn't like Jessica or Tim, he'll leave it to her. Luke glances through to the back of the shop to see that the coffee machine is nearly done. Good. He's gasping. He tidies up the clutter on the counter and notices a rose in the display on the floor, head hanging in shame. He takes it from the bucket and moves it into a vase out the back. We'll try to rescue it later. For a moment, it makes him think of Emily. He gave her a rose last Valentine's Day. They have had a coffee together since everything, and he is glad to have talked properly, that she knows how much he cares, how very sorry he is for all she went through. She is taking a break from school, a trip to stay with an aunt in France. She still doesn't want a relationship with anyone for a bit, but has said he can write. He is pleased about that. And then the shop bell tinkles. Luke smiles, thinking again of his mum. She so loves the old-fashioned sound. At first, he doesn't imagine it can be Tim. Thinks it's a customer. He looks older. Hi, my name's Tim. Hear about the job?
He stretches out his hand and Luke takes it,